Hey everybody, we're back with another commissioned podcast. This for a Coen Brothers film, their first film that they wrote and directed together. Sean Ray commissioned this podcast. This is for the 1984 film Blood Simple, directed by Joel Coen and written by both Joel and Ethan Coen. Now, knowing the Coen Brothers as I do I believe that at no point did Ethan step behind the camera and direct a few scenes here and there? No, I do not. But that's how it's credited on Wikipedia and IMDb.
Mm-hmm.
Jim,
and the movie itself.
And the movie itself. Jim, what did you think of this movie?
I thought it was pretty good. It's low budget-ish, and it's made in 1984, so you kind of get what you get there. Uh-huh. It doesn't look great, but I think, I don't know, overall it was pretty interesting.
I thought that, unfortunately, I didn't enjoy this movie on just a visceral movie watcher level. I saw this more as a historical interest because this is the Coen Brothers' first film, and you see a lot of proto efforts at creating suspense doing misdirection and comedy of errors and like these different tragic elements that they're and you know, people that are bad at crime that ultimately came together much more with much more polish and much more refinements in movies like Fargo, which
absolutely,
I think are better. The other thing is I thought this movie had a lot of pacing problems. Like every single time that the leads would get together and have an extended conversation in a car or in a bed or whatever, I was just like, wow, I don't know whether they were trying to build drama or what, but I found it slow. And then some of the goofy crime, not, I don't want to say goofy crime stuff, but some of the crime aspects, the inept crime aspects, felt weirdly low stakes. Because this is ultimately about a guy who finds out his wife is cheating on him and takes out of a hit.
Right.
And the hitman cutting corners and the miscommunications that arise from those situations and how kind of inept.
I don't think the hitman's cutting corners. I think the hitman double crosses him.
Well, I mean, I think the hitman did a little calculation. It's like, well, I can murder, instead of murdering two people, I can murder one person and get the same amount of money. That's what I mean by cutting corners.
Cutting corners, I would say, is getting the job done cheaply.
Okay.
Getting the job done.
You're right.
Maybe a little more sloppily than he should.
You're
here.
Right. That's like paying a general contractor to remodel two houses, and he remodels he blows up your house instead.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Fair point. but some of the stuff, like at the end, where you have the final scene of the private detective / killer stalking Francis McDormand.
Dormand. Yeah, I don't know how to say exactly her last name.
Sheriff Margie.
Right, Marge Gunderson from Fargo.
How he's kind of like, I didn't understand, like, why is he sticking his arm through this window? It seems only to make her think that it's her husband back from the grave to try to kill her and give her the opportunity. It's like, you know, and some of the stuff that Sean sent me, like in retrospect, feels like the Coen brothers had these like images.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, a man being buried alive, and oh, this gunfire coming through drywall in a dim room, and illuminating these shafts of light, and like they had all these really great visual aspects of the storytelling, and then came up with a scaffolding of a story to hang these set pieces on. So to me, it works better as like there's three vignettes in this movie that are kind of tense and interesting and exciting, but because of the budget and because of the me not engaging with the characters and the pacing problems, I don't think it worked as well as it could have.
Okay.
And I feel bad because, you know, again, this is the Coen's first movie. I feel like I should have sat up and took notice, but at this point, I've seen so many Coen films. Like, I think at this point, I've only not seen Inside Llewyn Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the one that they made like 2 years ago?
I think so.
That's the only one I haven't seen, and this is like a less polished version of all the stuff that I've seen before.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about all those criticisms. I mean, I think as a first attempt, it actually succeeds on a few levels that are surprising, more in the writing, I think. And you know, they co-wrote this, so they both get the credit for it. I don't know that I felt like the direction was quite as good, and I don't know if that's a consequence of it being low budget or the first-time director stuff. I don't know if he's a first-time director, but It was the first time they had conspired together to make a film like this. And the first feature length, which is a difficult thing to pull off.
Oh, sure.
So I don't want to get too down on him here, but I think there are a lot of interesting things that the movie does do that I enjoyed. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned kind of these moments, and I think that is sort of where this movie shines. Like, it doesn't take the tone where, you know, in what it's doing with these inept criminals. It doesn't take the tone where they're just complete bumbling idiots. It's more like they're in over their head, right?
It's kind of like what an average person would do if they were presented with this thing. And like, oh, God, I think my girlfriend might have murdered someone, and I love her, and I've got to do what I think I should do as a man, which is,
right.
You know, she's a flighty woman, and she doesn't know how to do these things properly, so I'm going to take my windbreaker and try to...
My windbreaker?
A hilarious thing, something designed to repel fluids.
Right.
I'm going to try to soak up a pool of blood with it. Like, I mean...
Good luck, buddy.
Now, the thing is, like, a lot of stuff, like, with, like, Jerry Gunderson in Fargo, uh-huh. It reads as comedy, because
right.
That's the way he plays it, but... the stars of this film, which, you know, you probably recognize, I think, is that guy,
them, yeah.
John Getz is the Ray.
He's the one I recognize the least.
Yeah.
The other three.
I just feel like if you have William H. Macy mugging for the camera, you'd get a little bit of intentional comedy out of that. But mm-hmm. this was like, some of this stuff was like, I think unintentional comedy that, you know, you're supposed to be like, oh my God, if I'm a average Joe trying to clean up a crime scene, and maybe in 1984 that concept was fresh enough that it worked a little better.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe it's just a consequence of this being the first attempt and they haven't quite nailed the tone in the directing, right?
Right.
I'm not sure, and I don't know. Like, clearly they're chasing this Fargo vision that they've got, right? This feeling, and it's all over this movie. It's just... It's not quite as refined.
And the one scene that was not like an action scene or I guess a plot driving scene that I thought worked was when Ray went back to the bar and confronted Marty for his 2 weeks.
On the back steps there.
And they're kind of dueling with each other. And I thought that actually was the one kind of moment where there was some the movie approached crackling tension.
Yeah.
But then there's a lot of stuff where like that scene where Ray is dragging the shovel over and kind of menacing Marty. Like, I just didn't buy it. I didn't feel like Ray was a... They needed both of these characters to be kind of badasses or to have a lot more mm-hmm. personal animosity than I guess I thought they did.
Mm-hmm. It very much seemed all business between them.
Yeah.
Until, you know, Marty says, you know, I've been thinking about it and thinking about it and need you to kill these fools.
Yeah. Well, you know, but it's like the slow dragging across the pavement, that red is something like kind of menacing rather than, you know, an everyman trying to commit a murder. Like, oh, I'm going to bury this guy alive, not because it's a cold-blooded thing to do, but because I'm too squicky to actually, like, I'm not going to kill this guy. I'm not going to beat this man to death with the shovel.
Right.
I'm just going to bury him, like, pretend like, you know, I'm just...
As if that's not giving him a death sentence, right?
Right. Yeah, it's a way, like, I thought
it's a way
that
to avoid
was,
responsibility.
That was kind of interesting psychologically. Exactly. Yeah. It's a way to, like, well, I didn't really kill him.
Right.
While, you know, yeah, you did. In fact, you're doing it in the most horrific, dehumanizing way possible.
And he later comes to terms with that. You know, he has the conversation with Abby where he tries to tell her that he's killed Marty. He never actually does. But he's like, he was alive when I buried him or something like that.
And everyone in the movie is trying to tell her that she's not like Maurice the bartender. It's like, no, he's not dead. And she thinks she's gotten, like, she misunderstands a phone call from, I keep wanting to say Bounty Hunter, but the Private Eye, the murderer's Private Eye.
I only know him as T.R. Polk from Camp Nowhere. The mid-90s kids.
I guess he's been in
movie.
So many stuff, but the only thing I can remember him being in is that crazy... Steve Martin film where he invents the magnetic eyeglasses and I think the funniest scene in the film is where there's a sniper trying to kill Steve Martin.
Much like this film.
And he's standing in front of all these oil cans and he mm-hmm. keeps missing and the oil and Steve Martin is like, oh my God, someone's got it out against the oil cans. I guess he's a pretty famous character actor and he's well regarded by a lot of people. But in this movie, he just plays a silly guy.
Yeah,
he's a silly guy who's in the business of murder and taking pictures he shouldn't be taking.
He plays a lot of private detectives, so at least in movies I've seen him in. So yeah, plays a sleazy guy.
So our private detectives, well, like I guess I always thought of them as the good guys. I never thought of private detectives like, oh, you want me to murder someone? Oh, sure, I'll murder someone.
Right, right. I don't know what the line is there, but apparently the Coens have a complicated relationship with them too, because in Big Lebowski, the private eye is clearly trying to do a thing for a family.
Mm.
He's not out to murder anybody.
Right.
He seems like a generally decent guy. But in this film, yeah, Emmett Walsh is, oof, he's a piece of work.
Yeah, and he's taunting this guy. Like, he doesn't, I feel like he doesn't feel, you know, give a shit about Morty. I will say that it's unfortunate that they gave Marty two first names, Julian,
yeah.
Marty. Because when I try to, when someone's first introduced, like, write their name down. And I think his wife, that's played by Frances, who is Emma? What's her name?
His wife, played by, Frances McDormand, Abby.
Abby, yeah Abby. Abby refers to him as Julian and being afraid of Julian. So then when people were talking about Marty, I'm like, who the fuck is Marty? And then Maurice, did I write down Maurice wrong? And it took me like most of the way through the movie to resolve who the hell Marty was.
Yeah.
So that's,
and then when Christopher
Lloyd
came in and said, Marty,
yeah, right,
I'm Back to the Future.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
really confused the issue. I don't know why they had that scene in there.
Your wife's boyfriend's going to murder you. I don't know.
So I thought the most disturbing thing about Marty was that he drinks Alka-Seltzer and milk. I just can't abide that. That's real gross.
You know what I want? Every time I'm drinking milk, I wish it was carbonated.
Oh, God.
Like, that's what it's missing. That's what it's missing.
I don't know that you're wrong, because I can't imagine it, but it sounds pretty gross.
I don't know. Do you?
So
I was going to say, because he's got, like, Sean's got a ton of stuff directed feedback that we can get into, or this, like, do you have, because that's the thing, like, since the movie didn't really hook me or engage me, like, I don't have as many natural conversation points.
Right.
But if you, yeah, by all means, if you've got them, keep them coming.
I mean, I've got random observations, and most of them are just silly, but what did you make of the title of this movie, Blood Simple?
So I saw that it's a reference to some kind of, I'm not sure if it's a historian or if this was a work of historical fiction, but someone describes people who have been in prolonged violent situations like war or hostage situations as blood simple. Like they're slow and kind of paranoid and not thinking straight. And I guess that describes, but what I don't understand is why these people are blood simple, because they seem to be in this guy's a bar owner and he's a sleazy bar owner, but he doesn't seem particularly violent or like have his elbows covered in blood. The guy's just a bartender. The woman's just a wife.
Yeah. I mean, I think halfway through they become blood simple. So like,
I wish the
confusion is the element that's introduced to me that makes them blood, quote unquote, blood simple.
I guess I would have, this movie would have worked a little bit more if they'd established Marty as more of a violent man, like to be feared.
I think so.
Because I felt like he just seemed like he was weak and ineffectual. Like I wouldn't be afraid of that guy. I wouldn't think him capable of taking a contract out on someone.
Okay. I mean, maybe not. It didn't seem like Ray had all that much fear of him. Like, he goes and he talks to him on the steps.
Sure.
Asks for his 2 weeks of pay, and he doesn't ever seem threatened by
But when
Marty.
Francis says, I'm not afraid of you, Marty, at the end, like, that red is like, well, why would you be? Why, you know?
Well, I mean, somewhere in the dialogue, I got the implication that Marty might be capable of either worse...
well, there's that bizarre
worst things than we see.
There's that bizarre pillow talk conversation where she says that Marty confessed to her that he thinks he might be anal.
Right? Yeah, I don't know what they were getting at there.
And I'm like, what? What?
That he might not be a lawyer.
I am not a lawyer. I didn't. Is that what you're talking about? Because that just read is like the bizarre statement to make. Not like
no.
He might be homicidal. He might be...
Right. I think that was a Coenism. I think that was a way of them trying to say something without actually saying it and using a weird word
that might not even be appropriate, because they are, I have come to appreciate that they're a bit trolly of their audience
sometimes,
which
with
is
stuff
something
like that.
I have a hard time, you know, understanding that impulse.
I guess I don't look at it as being trolly. I look at it more as like, we're going to do something that's a little weird and you're going to have to follow us down this hole, but we think you'll get it.
Okay.
And I think that's where they were going with that anal stuff, but no, there was some there was something else.
I was reading I was reading analysis, and there was people openly questioned whether that's supposed to be her way of saying that he might be gay.
Oh.
Because otherwise, if you take it in like the general colloquialism, like if I told you, it's like, oh, I have my anal, that's like I'm like obsessed with overly obsessed with details or cleanliness or you know, something like that. I'm prissy or uptight. It doesn't mean, but like her in 1984 expressing that might be fears that her husband's actually gay, or like is that some kind of sinister connotation? But since it doesn't really make sense on any kind of any reading of the word, certainly, like saying,
I'm afraid
my husband's anal doesn't mean like, oh, well, you should be terrified of him then.
Right. They are definitely trying to say something with that word. It's just not a common meaning. Or really, you'd never find it in the dictionary under anal. Like, that's not one of the meanings, but they're using it that way.
He's blood anal.
Movie.
He's just blood anal.
Oh, God. Yeah, but I don't know. So I thought it was really cool the way they kind of flipped the script on both of these main characters. I'm talking about Abby and Ray. Like, halfway through the movie, you know, the hit, T.R. Polk, whatever his name is, Emmett Walsh, kills Marty. And then Ray stumbles in on it and believes that his wife has killed, Marty's wife has killed him. Mm-hmm. And this, I thought this was set up brilliantly, because he knows that she has that gun. Mm-hmm. He finds the gun under the table where Emmett Walsh kicks it. And I don't know why he kicks that gun.
So I actually, because that confused the shit out of me. And I was reading a review that asserted that Ray kicked it and the gun goes off. Which, because like when we watched, I remember like, wait a second, is Ray psychic? Did he just have like a premonition of this all happening? But I don't, because again, I actually watched the movie twice.
Okay.
Because the first time I'm like, I was having a hard time connecting with it. But I still didn't get that. I still thought that was a bizarre kind of thing. And then, so I'm not even sure if that assertion is correct.
Okay. Well, regardless, he finds the gun and he assumes that Abby has killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Abby assumes that Ray killed Marty later on in the movie. And then I think Abby actually thinks that Marty is in that house trying to kill her at the end.
Oh, yeah. Don't, because she says through the door, I'm not afraid of you, Marty, when she's talking to the... I keep wanting to say he's a bounty hunter, but he's a private eye.
Right.
And then so, he says, well, ma'am, if I see him, I'll tell you, which...
Yeah, which I guess, does she hear that?
I think she does, yeah.
Okay, so she realizes at the end. But that, to me, is the brilliant part of this, is the confusion that is just scattered throughout this movie. Mm-hmm. And none of it feels like it's confusion for confusion's sake. Everybody has a reason to jump logically to the conclusion they jump to, I think.
Yeah, and that's rare. Like when you have these
types of,
if everyone just sits down and like, wait, what? What's going on? Let's huddle up and say, oh, okay, then the movie just falls apart. You don't have a movie. I thought that's a little bit more clever than your average version of that plot.
And there are maybe moments in the movie where that should have happened. Like, you know, Ray and Abby
have a pretty extended conversation of like, I've killed, that can't be, like, where you think that they would want to, instead of like, pause that conversation, like, oh, we'll continue to later, like, we need to this is important, let's get to the bottom of it.
Right. I really need to know, did you kill Marty?
Yeah.
Instead of just assuming that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know, it almost knocks it out of the park on that level for me. It's pretty strong there. And I think, you know, even Fargo doesn't have the level of confusion that this movie has, which, you know, Fargo has a lot of other things that
really
make it
better. Why do you say that?
Does
I
don't
have a lot
know.
Of confusion.
I mean, I mean, it has confusion, certainly. Right. I felt it more strongly in this movie.
Because honestly, Fargo, like, this is like the blueprint that Fargo was built off of. You have a contract being taken out. Mm-hmm. You have a person realizing the significance of it or having a mental calculation, deciding to alter the terms of that contract. Then you have a whole series of misunderstandings arising from that and frustrations. And the thing is like, there's a lot of little things. Like, at the end where the private investigator is laughing at the cosmic joke that he's realizing that this wife shot him and didn't even know who he was.
Right.
But he does, like, this explosive laugh that felt like weirdly edited. I feel like if the Coens made this movie today, that would have been a little bit more underplayed, so the actual humor, you know, the bitter irony would come through rather than just like, hee-haw kind of moment.
This guy was a lunatic through the whole thing.
Yeah, maybe try a couple different takes there, whatever your name is, and try to give us a bunch of different ranges and we'll see what plays. And also they wouldn't have, like, smash cut to him, and there would have been, like, some of the editing and direction are just a little unpolished.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. The other thing that's interesting is there are actually two. I don't know if I'd call the incinerator a red herring necessarily. It's a Chekhov's gun that never goes off. The lighter, though, is a red herring entirely.
Why?
Because the guy's dead by the end of the movie, right? It doesn't matter that lighter is left on that table.
Well, it mattered because that's what brought him. So what's weird is they set up two things. He left the lighter behind at the crime scene, but he also left the picture where he shows the two people dead. Either one of those things would be reason for him to go back to the bar and find it. It's weird that the Coens decided to do both. Because they showed him realizing, like,
my lighter's
gone. I mean,
they literally put fish on top of that lighter. I mean, if they didn't want it to be a red herring, maybe don't put the fish on it. But that's what I would call it, is a red herring. Because it ultimately, like, you're right, he could have gone back to the bar for that.
It's like if Humphrey Bogart had left his fedora and left shoe at the crime scene. Like, what?
And going back to
here's the other thing.
Why
do you gotta have two?
He goes back to the bar.
Uh huh.
But he doesn't do anything while he's there. He looks for the lighter and he leaves, doesn't he?
No, I think that's something I missed on the first time. But you notice how battered the safe door was?
Uh-huh.
There's evidence that he tried to break into that safe to get to retrieve the photograph that Marty, for some reason, stole. I guess he was going to do... Yeah, why
right.
did Marty...
And then Maurice sees that the thing is cleaned
out. Was Marty
going
to use that to blackmail
and...
him later? Like, why did he steal that picture?
Well, he burned him, right?
Well, so the bounty hunt, the private eye burnt them, but Marty kept one in his safe, and he did a sleight of hand when he was giving him the money. Why did he keep it? Was he going to blackmail him for the money back later, or?
Yeah, might have been an insurance policy. Sure.
Didn't work at any level.
No, it didn't. Got him killed.
But that's what I'm saying. It's like some of that visual storytelling, I think, was a little creaky, which made it harder to follow than it should have been. I don't... You know, and I guess that's first time director. You don't know all the shots you need. You don't need all the inserts. You don't need the stuff. It's like, we went from point A to point B. We really needed a point to go from point A to point C and put point B in there.
You know what they actually needed? So here's the one thing that I think is, I don't know, probably a continuity error, probably just an oversight in writing or direction. He's left his lighter on the table in the bar, right?
Yeah.
In the back office. He goes in, he grabs these pictures, and he burns them. It's not until after he burns these pictures that he realizes he's left his lighter at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible? Does a man with a lighter use some other means to light pictures on fire?
Yeah, and I saw, there's a discussion on Reddit where, like, the biggest logical leap of this movie is this guy who they've introduced as a chain smoker would take any time at all to...
He's got to drive. He's smoking while he's driving.
He's got to light up. Yeah, it's like to realize that he left his lighter behind, but...
And then he actually burned something without realizing he's left his lighter behind. What the fuck?
That's a good point. Well, the other thing is, like, there's like a lot of things like the lo-fi budget of this thing I've misdirected me. Like, they showed Marty breathing in a couple scenes, and I thought it was just, this guy's a shitty death actor, because sometimes in low-budget films, you can see a guy who's supposed to be dead, and you can see him, you know, breathing. Like, that happens all the time. But no, that was a plot point, the fact that he was breathing.
Yeah, I was with you. I thought he was dead.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. What,
Let's go into some of the feedback that he's got.
Okay, okay. He wanted to know what we thought of performances of the four leads. To be completely honest, the only one that I would have been impressed with at all was Frances McDormand. I thought John Getz as the boyfriend was a bowl of tapioca pudding
that me too.
I could not figure out. Like,
there were moments where he was scary.
He seems
very few.
Both him and Marty seem like average men that had the misfortune of falling in love with a more sophisticated, intelligent. Like, she's still in their ecosystem, but I felt maybe this is because of my affection for McDormand and all the other Cohen stuff she said, but I just felt like that she was bored because of the situation she was in, but she had a lot more depth, and she's never going to be satisfied by the situation or any of the people in it.
Right.
And they were the average guy that just, like, you know, punched way over their weight and is now just desperately trying to hold on to that thing. Dan Hedaya, who is the butt chin guy.
Okay. Yeah. Marty.
He's just okay. But
I agree.
Was he supposed to be menacing? Was he supposed to be inept? Was he supposed to be, you know, stupidly trusting? Like, I don't know.
More betrayal and desperation from him, which I'm not certain you're supposed to get desperation when he puts out a hit.
Right.
I think you were supposed to get some kind of scary feeling from him.
I guess I wanted him to be like Robert De Niro in Casino. Like that kind of owner, but he wasn't. Like, he owned some kind of bullshit honky
tonk like the grocery
that Patrick
King.
Swayze would bounce for, you know?
Like the Grocery King from Fargo season one.
Yeah.
That was
a more of
simultaneously
a
like a scary and in control character in a lot of ways.
M. Emmett Walsh, who was the aforementioned hitman / bounty hunter / private eye / bodyguard.
I think his name is, yeah.
I just felt he was this tremendously silly character. Like, but also a little hints of, like, this is the archetypal evil character, like primal evil character that the Coens like to play around with. Like, there's shades of the post-apocalyptic biker.
Okay.
From Raising Arizona. Like, that's like, he's like this, he's kind of slightly evil, but flamboyant foremost. And a lot of the same way that, like, Lorne Malvo was. I think the Coens wanted to, like, oh, you know, it's killers are boring. We want someone that's, like, you know, got a little pizzazz. Like, people are going to walk out of theater remembering this guy.
Right.
But not all of it quite worked. And I think some of it was, like, his line readings, and some of it was just the fact that, like, he was always seeming to be in on his own private joke that didn't fit the scene.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't work for me. So, like I said, like, of all these four people, I think the only one that really would stand out was Frances's portrayal. That she, there's something about her. I think she's super compelling.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. She does have a certain larger amount of charisma than most actors. I don't even know if she stood out for me. Honestly, across the board, like, a lot of the acting, certainly she was better than the other actors, but not head and shoulders for me.
Right. He wanted to know if we feel genuine concern for McDormand's character and disdain for Walsh's character. I didn't feel disdain. Why would I feel disdain for Walsh's character?
Because he betrayed, he backstabbed Marty.
We're not supposed to like Marty,
yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know that I'm supposed to write like Ray either.
We're supposed to like him because Abby likes him. And Abby's the one we're supposed to be identifying with.
Yeah. I like Abby. But, like, when that guy's groping his hand through the window, like, I never felt tension because, like, it's not like he's Mr. Fantastic. He can just stretch his arm out and grab her. He's not, like, some kind of unkillable movie ghost. He's just a chubby dude reaching his hand through a window. I saw it a mile away. She's going to slam the window down and stab it. And sure enough.
What was his plan? Open the window and then crawl out there and go in through the window?
Well, I mean, I guess that's the thing. It's like, oh, she's gone out the window. Before I get my fat ass out here on this ledge, let me see if there's the window. Like, how far away is the window and all that? Which I think you could quickly ascertain by just, like, briefly, up, that's there. But, like, it did feel like he was trying to, like, pour himself in through the window, T-1000 style. Like, that's not going to work, man. You got a skeleton.
Yeah.
That was weird. But, again, I feel like the Coen brothers, like, got high in the early 80s and, like, oh, man, we got to have this fiend. Like, there's got to be gunshots and there's got to be the shafts of light and there's got to be this hand creeping through the window. And we're going to bury a guy alive, and maybe he'll get ran over, maybe he won't, and will the guy get shot? And, like, all that stuff sounded super cool.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they just needed a better director. And I'm not saying that Joel is still a bad director.
In the same way that we needed better podcasts back in the day when we were doing Blue Yonders.
Right.
Like, there's some stuff there where you can see, like, oh, I can see how that eventually gets polished up into something that has fairly broad appeal, but yeah, we could use better podcasters in the early going there.
Yeah, and he's gotten much better.
They just needed reps. And the other thing is, this back in '80, like, also, yeah. I guess I'm unfairly judging this against their later works when really this is something in the '80s, and there's a lot of schlock in the '80s. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know why I see the movie like Commando. It's your archetype 80s schlocky action, and I just eat it all up. But it's just patently ridiculous, right? Like, why am I not? Because
they weren't going for anything bigger than what they got.
Right.
Right?
So why do I give that a pass?
Well, I think that's the reason. Like, there's no grand design here where they're like, oh, you need to feel the true tension in this scene, and we're gonna play fast and loose with the rules of cinema here. No. They're just fucking making an action movie.
But what I'm saying is, like, Blood Simple is to Fargo the way Commando is to True Lies.
Oh.
Because True Lies is just better in every way. It's better shot. It's better directed.
Sure.
The action's better. The villains are more compelling. Arnold he can actually string together a couple sentences. He's got a compelling. But I don't go back and watch Commando like, this is a piece of shit. This guy, like, what is he doing? Like, you know, what's he doing playing?
Maybe
with the...
because the core of that movie is literally just beating people up and being a big tough guy.
Right. Like this villain's cast looks like a tub of shit wearing a mesh tank top. Like, they clearly cast this guy just because he's just light enough for Arnold to pick him up with one leg. You know, like, I don't understand why I give it so much slack, and I'm like, I'm just, like, savaging Blood Simple, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, you're certainly...
I think Blood Simple is interesting. Like, I'm an archaeologist. I dug up this fossil, and I'm like, aha, here's the missing link that we got from here to Miller's Crossing and Fargo.
Right.
And instead of, like, oh, this is an interesting project in its own right. And also, I feel like maybe I'm pissing off Sean, which I don't, you know, thanks for your support.
Well, I liked it, Sean.
I
liked it.
I feel like that's traditionally my role, is to find the redeeming thing in the picture, and you're like, eh, whatever.
This is the rare one.
Finally, carry
inverted.
Me through this podcast, Jim. He wants to know where we feel like this lands on the list of Coen Brothers films you've seen, and how you feel about the direction and skill the Coen showed the first time out.
Oof.
That's where I think it's interesting, is like the quantum leap between this and any of the films they made through the 90s and the aughts.
Yeah.
Like, just how much more polish and how much, like, just the film stock being better. And
you know, I actually like this movie, I think, more than I liked, what is the name of their latest one?
Hail Caesar?
Hail Caesar, yeah.
Ooh.
I think
Hail
I
Caesar
liked this more.
Had that really awesome dance scene.
Well, damn it, you're right.
I mean, that was really fucking good.
It was a just purely
entertaining
scene.
I laughed out loud for a good 30 to 40 seconds.
And I hate Channing Tatum, and I still loved it.
Yeah. And then him as an eye, I was like, I mean, you can make that argument, but...
As a whole, like, the movie as a whole, I actually liked this better than Hail Caesar, for sure.
It certainly was more interesting in its premise.
Yeah.
But it had execution problems, where Hail Caesar was executed at a phenomenal level throughout, but the premise wasn't all that interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I think the more you know about the Golden Age of Hollywood and kind of Hollywood workings, that's why I thought there was a big discrepancy between the user reviews and the critical reviews, because the critics like to eat that shit up.
It's a filmmaker's film.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, like an insider film. It wasn't made for us.
Right. And then, you know, some of their movies are just beyond reproach. Like, Big Lebowski is one of my all-time favorite films.
I mean,
that's just top to bottom amazing.
And that, you know what? M. Emmett Walsh would have been right at home in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
Where he kind of felt like he stuck out like a sore thumb. Like, it's, if he was in... Well, but, like, Woody Harrelson is kind of like that way in No Country for Old Men. Like, he's this more flamboyant, flashy assassin, and, of course, you know, Javier Bardem just eats him for breakfast, so I guess that makes sense, but he kind of sticks out of that film. I want to say he should stick out of that film like a sore thumb, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
But then again,
that laugh, I don't know, it's just the
laugh.
That laugh
was just bad. Yeah, yeah, it really, like, they needed to do some normalization on it or something.
Lower it 3 octaves.
Go back to, right.
It'd just be weird.
Like, yeah, just like, that laugh should have been bitter. Like, and like it's, it, you know, bitter and resigned more than, like, genuine. A knee slapper, lady. What you just did is a knee slapper.
It felt like he was having a little too much fun telling this guy that his wife's cheating on him.
I know.
It just didn't feel right. Like, Marty should have got mad about that.
Yeah, like, you're in a
listen,
guy.
Listen, motherfucker, my wife's cheating on me. Don't laugh. This is not a laughing matter.
Also, you want me to pay you, right? But, and, like, right. And I guess he's dangerous enough that you also want him to kill his wife. I don't know. Yeah, that was a weird scene. Sean continues, the sequence of Ray finding Marty's body in the bar and then cleaning up the crime scene, driving his body to the field and bury Marty alive. One of the most tense sequences I've ever seen on film. What did you think
of it?
Was it
tense? I couldn't believe what I was seeing on screen. I was seeing a comedy of errors beyond anything I could possibly imagine.
Like, but it was almost unintentional comedy, but it didn't work like that, and it didn't work as intentional comedy. Once they got to the field, I agree with you.
Yes. The truck driving up the road, I thought was tense.
You see that DNA, like, much better executed in Fargo.
Right.
That exact scene of the traffic slowly overtaking something savage happening.
But that, when he first goes to clean it up, he just stuffs his jacket in a pool of blood. He gets blood on his hands. He leaves a boot print.
And
he
hilariously
picks up the
unfit.
Murder
it's
weapon like with the bloody hand.
The only thing worse he could have used to clean that crime scene up would be like a rain jacket.
Right. Yeah.
like he's trying to mop it up with a Ziploc bag. You know? It's like, it's just not going to work, man. It's not going
to
work.
Yeah, so no tension in that part of the scene.
Use your members only jacket to clean up a crime scene. But that, yeah, like, so I felt like that part didn't work, but once they got to the field, that shit was pretty effective.
Yeah.
Like, so watching someone get buried alive is pretty horrific.
Oh, yeah.
Especially just kind of like the... There's something extra cold and chilling about the everyman aspect of it.
Right.
Like, this guy's like, I'm just going to just keep doing what I'm doing, ignoring all the... I don't know. What'd you think of the final showdown between Private Detective Walsh's character and Abby? I didn't understand it. And then when he starts shooting through the drywall and then punching his way through the drywall and she's just sitting there watching it, like, I didn't know what I was supposed to think because... You know, this guy wasn't particularly menacing, and she had the gun. Yeah.
I think by the end of the movie, he becomes a little more menacing to me, because, you know, he still does his laugh thing toward the end, but I actually almost felt like it was, you know, it's not as good as Here's Johnny in The Shining, but it had that same kind of vibe to it. Like, him shooting through the wall, him punching at the wall.
Here's Lauren.
Right. He could have shoved his head through that hole.
Yeah.
Started cackling. But no, I felt like it did have a similar tension there to the guy breaking through the wall with the axe. I mean, or the door with the axe.
Right. Did you think it was a clever twist? The whole film, I was sure Ray and Marty would be the ones having a showdown. That's a good point.
Yeah,
because
I did like that.
There again, you see, that's kind of the DNA of No Country for Old Men. You think you're going to have this epic showdown between Sugar and what's his face?
Josh Brolin.
Yeah. But in the most tense scene is, and you never get to see the resolution of Sugar versus Brolin's wife.
Right.
So
yeah, it worked really well on that level for me. That's the level that it hit best for me, is the switcheroo and the confusion and the mistaken identities. Like, all of that stuff, the DNA of Fargo, really worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Both Ray and Abby came to believe the other murdered Marty, and neither will come clean and talk about what happened. What do you think about this, and does it say anything about their love for each other? I never thought that Abby loved Ray.
Okay.
And I don't think she loved Marty, and Marty was smart enough to know that, whereas Ray hasn't had the realization that, oh, she's not that into me, which is kind of makes him going to bat for her and the cleaning up the murder scene all the more tragic.
Right. He does that, and then he has a conversation, I think it's when he's asking for his money, where Marty says, look, one day she's going to do the same thing to you that she did to me, right? When she looks at you and says, like,
there's nothing funny here.
Right, I haven't done nothing funny.
And the fact that fed in, because that's essentially, because he's accusing her, not accusing her, but like, hey, you killed that dude and I helped you out. She's like, what are you talking about? There's nothing funny.
And that just reinforces that idea.
And started the kind of suspicion and paranoia between the two characters.
Yep.
Actually, what would have been really fucked up is if they'd had some way to engineer a situation where she thought Ray was Marty, and she ends up killing Ray, thinking she's protecting herself from Marty. I kind of like thought that would have been better than having, you know, McGee go through the window, but whatever.
Yeah, well, he got shot dead.
As the private eye dives under sink, the final shot is him looking up at the sink and seeing condensation begin to build and slowly fall on him. What do you think the Coen brothers were trying to say with their ending their film like this? We also see flies surrounding him in a few scenes in a film. Is that true? I didn't notice any particular frequency of flies buzzing around him. Did I just not pick it up?
I definitely noticed it in at least one scene.
Because if that's the case, that goes back to, like, you know, Eric Wahlquist, who's a Coen brothers aficionado, that the Coen brothers like to play with this idea of this unstoppable, evil, demonic force. And, you know, a lot of flies are associated with Satan, and they're trying to make this guy a satanic, menacing figure. I would say that maybe there's some proto elements of that, but they didn't quite have a handle on it, and maybe that's what they're trying to do with the flies, is just like, oh, he's the Lord of the Flies, he's evil, he's a chaotic evil character.
Maybe.
But what about I'm not sure about the sink thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I really couldn't tell you about the sink.
Well, I mean, again, if the whole cosmic joke aspect of it is kind of like, you know, when you're dying, your life flashes before your eyes, and the fact that, you know, you're witnessing this condensation form and this, like, purely cosmic, you know, it's purely, there's no design or thought behind this, and there's like suspension, and there's also the concept of like Chinese water torture, like the just getting driven mad by these drops hitting your head. I think all of that is kind of there, but also, I know for a fact that Coen brothers sometimes put shit like in this just to have people talking about it for no good reason.
Okay. So you know, that's pretty trolly.
So it could just be that's the first thing. It's like, oh, you know what? We'll zoom in on this moisture drop falling and that'll blow fuckers' minds.
That's a shitty thing to do at the very end of the movie where you should be making a statement.
I mean, but why? Why is it any more valid than any other kind of way to end up a movie?
I mean, you're supposed to sum it all up, right? Like, what was this movie about in the final shots?
I mean, like, the thing is, like, there was no real meaning here. Like, it was all random acts of...
Maybe it is. Maybe it does sum it up.
Like, this thing spinning out of control, and now this is just like, you know, why is the drop falling? Well, why did he double-cross his thing? Why did the guy decide he wanted to kill his wife instead of just like, okay, I'm going to go and kick her out of my house and go on living my badass low rent CD bar owner life. I'm sure I can get a Frances McDormand just right off the just they're flying off the shelves, man. If you're a CD bar owner,
I don't know. Debbie's the only one. Is it Debbie? Is it the Steven Tyler look-alike? Deborah? The Coens have something a serious thing for actors with Buscemi teeth. Is all
oh,
I'm saying.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. She's got
I don't want to make fun of her too much.
She's a few years of not brushing away from having full on a Buscemi situation.
She's got Steven Tyler face and Buscemi teeth. It's not good. It's a bad situation.
So
in that scene, by the way, with Deborah, where Maurice hitting on her at the bar, I thought we were going to get a full on dance sequence when he goes over to the jukebox and he starts the song, and then he jumps up on the bar and kicks his feet.
Yeah,
I'm thinking, here we go.
Maybe we need a Hail Caesar dance number in there to elevate it. Yeah, Yeah, because he did that little like a soft shoe, or almost like a, Muhammad Ali boxing kind of move.
Yep.
Keeping his shit quick. And then later on, they had like a stripper get up there, and but all we saw was her feet.
Yeah, that was weird.
The Coens are closet foot fetishes.
Is the name of this bar Neon Boots?
Or is that a brand of beer? I don't know.
Bar, there was a neon sign that said bar above it and then Neon Boots.
But it was the size of like a Miller sign.
I know.
You know?
Yeah. I've never heard of Neon Boots as far as beer goes, but
I think that's one of the artifacts from the Doctor Strange movie. Neon Boots of Leaping.
Right.
Okay. Final thought from Sean. Joel Coen was an assistant editor on Sam Raimi's original Evil Dead. The Coens and Raimi had become friends, and when the Coens told Raimi about their idea for Blood Simple, he convinced them to create a proof-of-concept trailer to show potential investors. Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell starred in it, and it worked. The Coens are able to raise enough funds to make the movie. You can find it here, which he links to YouTube. I think fans of the movie or Coen Brothers fans in general might appreciate this bit of background, and hopefully you and Jim do as well. I will say, after seeing this trailer, that this movie was Raimi as this trailer is Raimi as fuck.
Yeah.
Like, there's way more Raimi camera moves and touches than there were Coen Brothers.
Absolutely. I'm glad they didn't shoot this whole movie that way, because Sam Raimi has a style that I think needs to be just Sam Raimi's style.
Right.
And I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it would have worked at all in this movie. And that trailer feels real weird.
It really banged home the idea that they had the sequence of like vaguely menacing things, like the bullets coming through the wall and this the shovel being slowly drug, and they had these ideas, and they're like, you know, describing this, and now look at this trailer.
But also felt like Sam Raimi was just over Joel's shoulder pointing and saying, stick the camera there.
Yeah.
Now grab this camera and run up toward
run
this
over,
guy.
Run over to Cadillac. And,
right.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, that is a Sam Raimi trailer. That is not a Joel Coen trailer.
It is very Sam Raimi. Like, he didn't just start. Like, I feel like he held the camera through 90% of it, too.
Yeah. Feels like it.
But no, it's super interesting. I will link that in the show notes as well, so that you guys, if you want to check it out, I'm sure it's probably... No, the other thing that I thought was interesting about this is that there's a director's edition that's actually 3 minutes shorter than the original release, because I guess the Coen brothers went and like removed a couple scenes and really tightened up the dialogue, which I kind of wish maybe I'd seen that version, because some of the stuff that sounds like some of the more plotty aspects of it, they might have doctored up and addressed.
Yeah. Took out the anal stuff.
The blood anal. Oh, don't God. Need any blood anal, man.
No.
But yeah, I think, again, I'm glad I saw this, because it's I'm one step closer to seeing all of the Raimi, or the all. See, they got me. He's hijacked it. All of the Coen brothers movies.
Yeah.
And I do think that this is extremely interesting to see, like, the how many different ways that they've respun this into better films.
Mm-hmm.
Like the inept criminality, the double dealing and deception, the confusion from multiple characters, and not fully understanding. The unstoppable evil forces, like all these things are in a very protozoan and Promethean kind of way in this film.
Yep.
And it's like, and I'd almost encourage people, like, if you haven't seen a lot of Coen brothers, like, see this one first.
Sure. Yeah.
So then you can be like, oh yeah, when you see Fargo, this is like they took that formula and perfected it, or No Country for Old Men. Oh yeah, I see what they're going with that. Or even like you said, some of these flamboyant characters, they it's like, what if we made a movie where everyone is as flamboyant as what's that
Lauren.
Guy's? Yeah, as Lauren, and then you got something like The Big Lebowski.
Right.
So, or Raising Arizona is another example of, like, if you took a film and just filled it full of guys like that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you're going to have a guy man in a 7-Eleven, he's going to be this version of the guy man in a 7-Eleven.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I appreciate that, Sean. Thank you so much for your support and for commissioning this movie. And we will have, I don't know, do you happen to know what the next one we're talking about?
Next one's Point Break.
Oh.
So that should be a fun one.
Oh, and this is the Nattercast special.
Yeah.
Have you seen Point Break, the original?
Yeah. Oh, fuck yeah.
Okay.
Multiple times.
Good. That should be another
classic. Gary Busey. You got Patrick Swayze. You got
Gary
Neo.
Busey's teeth.
Oh, man.
All making starring turns. Yeah, this is going to be a fun one. I can't wait. We'll be back probably next week with that. Again, thanks, Sean. If you'd like to find out how you can commission your very own podcast, it's easy. Go to baldmove.com/shop and click on the big film canister looking thing. Two ways to do it. You can either pay up front for your own commission, or you can chip in $10 at a time for community commissions and pull together the whole Bald Move community to make a more something a little bit more on menu happen. But yeah, there you go. We'll be back sometime in the future, and until then, I'm Aaron
and I'm Jim.
See ya.